From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we discuss the recent BBC documentary, Murder in Milwaukee. Some of the film's participants are unhappy with the way the city was portrayed.
We all came together to better the area, and a lot of changes happened. A lot of things are different. A lot of the shootings and murders have decreased by 68%. And none of that was depicted.
Then we talk with cat behavior specialist Jackson Galaxy about how to best live with the small tigers we call house cats.
If you understand them from motivations to body language, then you have a different starting point, which will hopefully give you more patience and more empathy with the animal that you live with.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabulo. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Murder in Milwaukee. That's the name of a new documentary from the BBC. The documentary chronicles the Milwaukee Police Department as it works to curb gun violence and looks at the relationship between police and African Americans.
But the depiction of Milwaukee as a lawless city has angered some community activists. WUWM reporters Aisha Turner and Latoya Dennis spoke with two of the people featured in the documentary.
Shonda Payne is an EMT. She also runs Unity in the Community, a grassroots movement to quell gang violence. That work is left out of the BBC documentary. What's included is Payne's own history as a gang member. And Thaddeus Ashford, who sometimes goes by Taz, he's the cousin of Sylville Smith, the man killed by a police officer in the Sherman Park neighborhood last August.
Just to kind of start off with the two of you, Shonda and Taz, you're both featured pretty heavily in the documentary. And I'm wondering if you all have seen it and what your general reaction was.
I definitely have not watched the documentary. I watched the little snippets, and from that point, really didn't have an interest to go further because it was not featuring me in the best light. So, I mean, why torture myself any further? Taz?
Me personally, I didn't want to see it. I didn't really too much care for it after the fact. I seen all the feedback from it. Like, you know, I just had the vibe off the feedback and then didn't want to see it because it was just seemed like to be a negative thing when it all came to light.
What were people saying to you all about it?
On my end, there was a lot of mixed reviews. A lot of people were, you know, prayers with you and your family, respect you for doing what you're doing to protect your family. Some people were, you are utterly ridiculous to have 9 firearms in one house. Some people were, can I have your autograph? Some people were, it was mixed reviews. It wasn't anything that you just want to sit down and dedicate too much time to, because it was, you know, I've got a lot of patience, but with some of the comments, you know, they were kind of forcing me back to be that 90s child. I wasn't going in the right direction, so it's better to shut up than say the wrong thing.
What did you think it was going to be, the documentary?
What they portrayed it to be initially was that they were coming about the violence and the things that were happening, but what we thought was going to happen was that they were going to start with, when I initially came to that area and started Unity in the Community, and we all came together to better the area, and a lot of changes happened. A lot of things are different. A lot of the shootings and murders have decreased by 68%, and none of that was depicted. You know, it was stuck on that first initial thing that they all came for, which was how many shootings can we see? How many people can we watch die?
Can you talk a little bit about what Unity and Community is?
What unity in the community is, being a part of the Vice Lords for 28 years, what I did is I took the initiative to say a lot of the violence was happening between, you know, the two different gangs, you know, senseless, fighting over nothing, pretty much. And watching my kids grow up, and all are mainly boys, and the chances of their survival out here are slim to none if things continue to be the way that they are. So, saying, you know, what part could I do to bring together growth and development, Vice Lords, to say, you know, let's sit down, let's have a round table, let's figure out why, who, what, when, where, and why this is happening. And their people sat down, talked with me. We came to an agreement of a ceasefire. And that changed a lot of things, you know.
Is that something that you talked to the BBC about?
Oh, definitely. But like I said, they took the bits and pieces that they wanted from that. And, you know, it's media, you know. Who's going to watch me cooking rice and reading to my kids, you know? Who wants to see that? It was exaggerated. It was sensationalized. We all know Milwaukee has its issues, its problems, but Milwaukee is also a great place, can be a better place, but it takes the grassroots people, Taz, myself, Freedom Fighters, Program the Parks, people with the passion to stick it out.
I was curious how they presented it to you, Taz, the documentary.
Well, they presented it to me as they wanted to, you know, film basically what we was going through, because it basically struck, you know, an ear somewhere in London, and it brought to their attention, you know, what we went through here about us losing Seville, you know, due to police brutality. But, you know, when they start coming with the interview and everything like that, we start doing it, that's when, you know, like, questions start coming out about how many kids you got, how many baby mamas you got, and, like, you know what I mean, do you have guns and all, like, all type of, you know, questions.
Yeah, and so Von Mays Bay, who's a local community activist here and runs Program the Parks, he actually posted the raw footage that he shot of you and Sidan, Seville's brother, being interviewed by the BBC last summer, you know, talking about the fact that at the memorial where you guys were being interviewed, there'd been a really heavy police presence. And you're kind of trying to describe all of the police that are down the street looking at what's going on.
They know it's little, too much they can do to me. You know what I mean? All eyes on me. I can't show up in a mugshot, beat up, and they done killed my brother.
Right.
It's not gonna look good.
Right.
So it's not too much they can do, you know what I mean, as far as to me.
We already had conversations with them. But
do you have kids either of you?
Yeah. I got four. I got four boys.
Really?
I got four boys.
4 points.
I stand out here every day to
make
sure.
You're 24 years old.
24. I got four boys.
Are you married?
I'm not married.
Are they with how many moms?
Four moms.
Damn.
Four moms. You want to get in person? But
do you not think it's hard to be a dad to four kids by 4 months?
It is, but at the end of the day, I handle my business. It's how you look at it. You know what I mean? I embrace my kids. And the reason I stand for my brother and how I stand for what I stand for is so the police don't gun my kids down, or my nephew he left behind down, or anybody that stand with me down. You know what I'm saying?
And I wasn't trying to be rude. So I was, you know, trying to just answer the questions as best as I could. But, you know, like I had the eye and I said, you know what, this ain't really, they asking too many, you know, sideline questions. They ain't even really sticking to the main, you know, script. You know, it's a lot of stuff that me personally, that I've been out here doing. We was in Sherman Park a couple months ago. We gave out over 300 some book bags to kids and everything like that. Like, you know, the whole thing was lit to see all them faces and all that. You know what I mean? So, like, it's a lot of stuff we've been doing. Like, we've been doing barbecues where we've been spending our own money and just giving stuff away. Like, you know what I mean? I still do stuff. I still am going to do stuff. I'm not going to let BBC, some new cast, sit back there and to try to use me to deteriorate my culture, my race, by a misagenda or a hidden agenda they try to come over and do. That's not the purpose. That's not what that film was about. That was not what my intentions of being in that film was about. Our intention was to get there. Hey, listen, we victims of police brutality, and we need to be heard, and we ain't finna back down from this.
Is one of your concerns the fact that it's not that what was highlighted isn't necessarily true? Is that none of the positive was shown?
Yeah,
it just
none of the positive was there. Like, it was nothing positive was there. Like she said, this
exactly.
She has college, you know, degrees and everything like that. You know, I just posted one of her graduation pictures on my Instagram to post back on Facebook to let them, hey, BBC, y'all didn't include this. You know what I mean? Like, I got accolades that's on my refrigerator that you would think, if you walk in my house, my daughter would be like, oh, so many awards on this refrigerator. No, them mines. Like, you know what I mean? I got, you know, them me, they didn't include that. You see what I'm saying? I do home health care and anything like that. You know, I've been doing this for a year. You know what I mean? I got four residents that I take care of. They didn't include that. You see what I'm saying? They didn't include a lot of stuff for a fact that we do. They didn't include that we go out here and we patrol, you know, neighborhoods that been victimized by people losing their life and loved ones, and we live in after hours, and we didn't tuck our kids, and we still out here patrolling the streets. They didn't include none of that. You know what I mean? They didn't include nothing in
the community
what we do.
Feedings we do, you know, weekly, and it's out of our own pockets. We get no funds from the state. We get no funds from anywhere. It's all collaboration of Taz, myself, Freedom Fighters, Program the Parks. We all, if one of us is doing something, we all come together and look out for one another. You know, we cook dishes, we go buy food, we hand it out, we, with nothing asked back in return. It's just, you know, and we're not looking for somebody to pat us on the back. It's just, don't project us as gun-toting, you know, thuggish, ruggish, you know, people. We all are very passionate about what we're doing, how we're doing it, and that's what matters to us.
Why does the outside perception matter? Like, if people watch this film, right, and they're going to, because it's, like, such a negative portrayal, they're obviously going to think negative things. What impact does that then have?
That guy has, for a fact, has 1.7 million followers. That's just on Twitter. So if he had 1.7 million followers, just think how many followers or people have seen that. For a fact, I would think within that day or within 48 hours, that film already reached 5 million viewers.
Eight.
We'll see it ballpark eight. But, and the thing about it is, you never know what type of resources that we could have got from any other country or anybody else that was on the outs that can help us with anything. But look at the image they're gonna portray. You trying to help them, what they gonna do? This what they doing with the money? They having babies. They commit murders. They selling drugs. They
buying
toting guns. Like, this what they doing? So you gotta understand, a lot of foreign countries, when then you gotta understand, if it's not this, if Milwaukee or Wisconsin they want to help, just think, that's a foreign country. They might not want to send any of their imports to here. Like, you know, we don't want to send our money. We don't want to help those, especially the minorities. Who are the minorities? The ones that came over and filmed, the blacks. Like, you know, we don't want to help them. We want to help the ones that's doing something. Let's help the suburban areas. We don't want to help the inner city areas. Do what they're going to do. All they're going to do is multiply, have babies, sell drugs, be off drugs, and have guns and kill each other in the community.
I want to ask how important it is for you all to tell your own narratives. And I ask that question because you've been live streaming this entire conversation.
It's just because of what has happened with the BBC. We definitely don't want something to get misconstrued or reported wrong, or just because I'm like the face of probably about 300 memes right now, and all of them are seriously negative. my kids are like, whoa. So I just want everything to be, you know, where I can go back and say, that didn't happen, or that's the truth, that ain't, or you know.
LaToya, for you.
Oh, here we go.
LaToya didn't want me to ask her questions, but I'm curious to pick her brain. How do you go about building trust with people that you're reporting on and holding yourself accountable when you're doing a story?
One, I try not to drop in and drop out, right? So if I'm with you, I'm not coming to talk to you for 5 minutes and then saying, okay, I have to go, right? I want to know who you are, the good and the bad, and I want to be able to, like I said, portray you as a whole person. And then not only that, typically after my story's there, I follow up with you. I send it to you, and I say, hey, here it is. Please let me know what you think. I'm saying, hey, I live in this community. You're a part of this community. We need to work together because I'm not going anywhere and neither are you. So let's build this relationship.
Also, you might see the person next week. Milwaukee's small.
Yeah. It's like I have nowhere to go, right? And I don't want anyone coming. Not only is it that I don't want someone coming after me, but I think that... I mean, I take my job seriously. What about you? Let's turn the tables.
I mean, I think I came into this work critical of journalism. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of enter with just an awareness of how damaging stories can be, especially to communities of color or to just any marginalized community. And so I think I spend a lot of time and... angst sort of making sure that I do it right and making sure that I'm representing someone fully. I think that's sort of the word that I keep coming back to is like that idea of like how do you, because there's good and there's bad and it's all of these things, and like how do you tell a full picture of what's going on and do it with like care and compassion.
I'm from Flint, Michigan. There's this documentary called Roger and Me, right? Roger and Me was about the downfall of General Motors. My entire family worked for General Motors. But this was, I don't know, in the 80s, I think, maybe early 90s, that this documentary was made by Michael Moore. And so in this documentary, there's this scene where he shows this person skinning a rabbit. I have never in my life, especially back then, seen anyone skinning a rabbit in Flint, Michigan, right? And so I look at that, and I've always said, as a journalist, to find that one person doing that one thing, it's like, yes. As a person from that community, I look and I say, how sensational. So wherever it is that I work, I also live, and I think of that as my community. So I don't want to just be that journalist, right? I want to be that community member as well. And I always look at it from that viewpoint.
Let's show what they neglected to show. Let's show the real Milwaukee, you know, and the people that are in it, that are changing lives, that have changed their lives, that have children, that are mothers, fathers, and really out here doing our best to make a difference.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
That was WUWM's LaToya Dennis and Aisha Turner speaking with Shonda Payne and Thaddeus Ashford, two of the people featured in the BBC documentary Murder in Milwaukee.
Payne and Ashford are planning to work with other community activists to put together their own documentary about life in Milwaukee, one that will be told in their own words.
Coming up next, cat behavior expert Jackson Galaxy was in Milwaukee earlier this week. We spoke with him before his event and got a preview of his new book, Total Cat Mojo. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
More of Lake Effect Weekend now. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Anyone who has ever interacted with a cat will tell you they can be perplexing animals. But cat behaviorist Jackson Galaxy would argue that a lot of that confusion comes from what he terms looking at cats through dog-colored glasses.
Galaxy is the host of My Cat from Hell on Animal Planet, and his new book, Total Cat Mojo, is a complete guide to understanding the felines in your life. Galaxy was in Milwaukee earlier this week for an event at Turner Hall, but he had a chance to speak with Joy Powers over the phone before his trip.
Jackson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
It's my pleasure. I'm really glad to be here.
So this isn't your first foray into book writing. You have this new book, Total Cat Mojo, but it does seem to be pretty different from your previous books. How do you compare it to your books like Catify, To Satisfy, or Catification?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the other books would sort of gloss over the whole shebang, and really, Total Cat Mojo is the whole shebang. I mean, it's pretty much everything I know about cats in one place, which was a really scary undertaking, I got to tell you. I mean, it was a tough thing to put down, you know, but no, the other ones, you know, for instance, Catification was really about designing, you know, your home for cats, Catify, To Satisfy, a follow-up, and Cat Daddy was a memoir, but it had helpful tips throughout. And this one is really soup to nuts, you know, it's everything I know.
How did you compile this information? How did you weed out what you felt like didn't need to be there and put in really the information that any cat owner needs to know?
Well, for me, you know, when I first started not just learning about cats, but teaching about cats, a lot of it was about, you know, how to get it into a form that could easily be digested by people, because honestly, cats are so unknowable, you know, to so many people as opposed to dogs. So I really tried to narrow it down and try to give people this starting point. And the concept of Cat Mojo was that starting point. And that is this concept of the utmost confidence that a cat can have. And that's based in their sort of natural state, you know, what I call the raw cat, and everything that feeds into that. And so the whole book became this, as long as it had something to do with mojo, it was going in the book. As long as I could connect it to confidence and to, you know, a cat's natural sense of being and a place in the world, then that's what went in there.
You do use this term, mojo, cat mojo. How do you define that, and what does it really encompass?
Cat mojo is, and it's funny because there's a whole chapter in the book where I start talking about doing this speech in, I think it was in Colombia or Argentina, and I was talking through a translator, and I start talking about the concept of mojo, and all of a sudden there's crickets, like nobody was getting it. And I suddenly realized that nobody understood what the term mojo meant. I always thought that the concept of mojo was sort of this thing that everybody knew, like, you know, I got my mojo working, you know, that kind of thing, but nobody did. So mojo is, when you say I've got my mojo working, I got my mojo on, it's like this natural swagger. It's this natural sense of confidence, not cockiness, just an inner sense of confidence that radiates out to the rest of the world. And the example I use is John Travolta at the beginning of Saturday Night Fever walking down the street. And like, he's got that natural strut because the guy owns Brooklyn, you know. Cats own space if they're allowed to play into the things that their ancestors would need, which is, you know, the concept of territory is sacred, and I need to have pieces of that territory in order to feel that I own it. And the second thing is their natural need to wake up in the morning, hunt, catch, kill, and eat. Now, if they can't do that, which living in your apartment, we would hope they can't do that, then what we do to replace that need in a more acceptable way to humans is what feeds into that mojo. So again, it's about confidence. I mean, don't forget, cats are here for one reason. They have stayed along with us for tens of thousands of years, not because they were pets, but because they did a job. And that job was to kill other things. And they did it really well, and they continue to do it well. So as they transition into this world of being pets in people's homes and apartments, we still have to feed the beast, as it were. And of course, there's creative ways to do it. And that's a lot of what this book is about.
You know, you mentioned before about cats, of course, being compared to dogs. And you often hear people say things like, you know, well, I'm not a cat person, or I really don't get cats. And there does seem to be this disconnect between people and cats specifically. What are some of the barriers that people seem to have in communicating with cats in general?
The biggest thing is what I call looking at cats through dog-colored glasses. I mean, we expect cats to act like dogs. And other than the fact that they have four legs and they live in our house, that's really where it ends. I mean, dogs we have built to act the way we recognize, to do things for us, to look to us for appreciation, love, and cats don't. It wasn't what we had them around to do. We really didn't selectively breed cats for certain behaviors all these years. So it's really important to look at a cat for what they are, which is, in my point of view, a barely domesticated animal living in your house. And as such, and this is a tough part for a lot of people, you have to compromise with a cat in order to have a good life with them. And that's, like I said, that's kind of tough for people to swallow.
Yeah, what are the kinds of issues that this kind of miscommunication can cause with cats and their owners?
You know, one of the things about the sort of inscrutability that cats have always sort of had with humans is that we then project our worst traits onto them. So if a cat's sitting there staring at you and you happen to have had a bad day, you can easily go to the cat hates me because you don't know what else you're looking for, you know? And then, God forbid, the cat does something like pee in your shoe, you know, it's all bets off. And all of a sudden they're the worst animal. They're the worst pet. They hate you. They hate the family. They, you know, and we dive off into this projection deep end that's part of what I think my job is to have you step away from that. And if you understand them from motivations to body language, then you have a different starting point, which will hopefully give you more patience and more empathy with the animal that you live with.
So when you're talking to people about their cats, whether it's on the television show or just in life in general, what are some of the common behaviors that people find really mystifying?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have a job if it weren't for cats peeing and pooping outside the box. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It's pee and poop, blood and guts. I mean, if it's aggression or litter box behavior, that's what stumps people. And that's the way the cats act out the most. So, you know, it's those things. I mean, there is no greater insult to a human being than to have a cat pee on your stuff, or that you're petting a cat and suddenly they turn on you and bite you. And it's always random, or it's out of the blue, and I didn't do anything, and why does my cat hate me? And again, my hope is you read this book and that phrase will never come out of your mouth again. You know, it was out of the blue. It was random. You know, that kind of thing.
Now, there are a lot of misconceptions, I think, about cats in general, ranging from, like, folklore about them being evil or stealing the spirits of babies, which is an actual folklore.
Yeah.
But there are others that are still pretty detrimental, even if they aren't sort of mystical in that way. What are some of these common misconceptions?
Well, I mean, the sense that cats are solitary and aloof, I think, is one of the biggest ones. You know, and God knows the world of cartoons and such, you know, such things have really propagated that. But honestly, it's not the case. Cats are incredibly social animals. They don't live by themselves out in the wild. They live in colonies. They even nurse each other's young. They're very communal minded. The only thing that cats do in a solitary way is hunt. Other than that, they need company. So the way they need and the way they show that need is completely different from the way a dog does it. And that's really where we have to start again, that a cat's not a dog.
What are some of their unique emotional needs? Because as you said, they do come off as being aloof, as not wanting that kind of community.
But again, I think that the reason we're saying that is because we're thinking of dogs. So when we think of a dog wanting something, we think of the big wagging tail and the sort of slobbering and the panting really, really hard and their ears going down and looking really cute at you and pawing at you. And that's how we say, my dog loves me, my dog wants my attention. And because cats just don't express that way, we go the other end. Cats are, in terms of communication, they're much quieter. They don't demand the way dogs demand, and they don't expect what dogs expect, you know? I mean, I know I'm painting this with a huge brush, but what we call aloof is only in place because of that comparative place that we start from. For instance, you know, this whole thing that I've talked about for years, the cat I love you, or the slow blink, that is my way of breaking the ice with a cat. that a slow, soft blink that they then return to you is a way of them saying, I trust you. I love you. I trust you. And for a wild animal to close their eyes to what could be prey or predator is a huge thing, you know? Another example is what I call the cat hug, which is a cat who rolls on their back for you. Now, is that an invitation to rub their belly? No. And then you're going to find out because they're going to scratch you when you try to rub their belly. But again, that show of vulnerability, that show of that center line, which in the wild, you show any animal that center line and you risk being completely eviscerated. That show is the ultimate trust for an animal that lives by their wits, who is right in the middle of the food chain. We have to remember who we're living with, you know?
So who do you think is the audience for Total Cat Mojo? Is it someone who's just gotten a cat, who might be getting a cat, or is it someone who has a lot of experience?
Everybody. Honestly, I don't usually toot my horn about things. I really don't. This book, to me, is what I get to sort of leave behind. I mean, I'm probably not going to write another book for a while. This was sort of everything that I could give everybody. And that means whether you've never had a cat before, whether you're afraid of cats, whether you hate cats, because I know that I can get you past that place, or whether you've had cats all your life, I know that there's something that you can walk away with that you didn't have before. The most important thing that I weave throughout the book is the concept of relationship. The concept that you don't own a cat. They're not just something you have. It's a relationship that you're in. And cats do mirror a lot of human relationships. And for instance, if you want to have a successful relationship with a human, you have to be prepared to compromise, to listen when you don't feel like it, to actually bend in a way that is inconvenient to you. A successful relationship with a cat demands the same. And I know that sounds kind of, you know, maybe over the top a little bit, but the bottom line is the payoff is huge. And it's not just about getting a cat not to pee on stuff or not to be aggressive. It's a level of connection that I have found is so incredibly deep. And that's the payoff, you know, it's a lifelong relationship. And I think that if we start to approach living with cats, or any animal for that matter, as a relationship, good things happen and bad things are less apt to happen.
Well, Jackson Galaxy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
It's been my pleasure, Joy. Thanks for having me.
Jackson Galaxy is the author of Total Cat Mojo and the host of My Cat from Hell on Animal Planet. There is more information about his work at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then it's time for our storytelling series, X Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to X Fabula!
True personal story.
X Fabula!
X Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
Amazing as it may seem, another week has gone by, and we are back for another edition of X Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I am Bruce Winter with Leah Delaney, the co-founder of Milwaukee's X Fabula. And just looking at the calendar ahead, November is full of X Fab stuff.
Oh, you betcha.
Oh, yeah. My goodness.
For a couple of working stiffs like us. And we'll talk about that in a second. Our upcoming events. Holy cats. Okay, November is going to be no slouch of a month. So November 14th, we have an Equal Access Story Circle happening. On November 17th, a curated Risking It Story Slam in partnership with the South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center. And on November 21st, a volunteer orientation at the Martin Luther King Jr. Library. More information, all information, can be found at xfabula.org.
And our stories today, as always, are on a theme, and our theme of this week...
Work. You better workity work, work, work it out. I brought work stories today. Reason being is that on November 9th, Our next monthly Story Slam is going to be held at 3041 North, which is a fantastic event space. If you haven't been, here's your opportunity.
You guys, you had a show there last season, didn't you?
We had a couple. Yes. Yeah, we keep coming back. Thank you so much, 3041 North. And next Thursday, we'll be telling those work stories. No water cooler required for this event. So let's just kind of get a taste of what type of work stories maybe you might have to bring to the table.
All right.
So our first story is going to be from My Life of Crime Story Slam back in November 2015. Here's Dan Williams with his DQ story.
By the sound of your applause, your expectations are way too high. So first off, I am not a Nadian, Wisconsinite, or Milwaukeean. This is a shared city for me. So I would ask that you excuse any colloquialisms or Southern drawl you have. You see, I am from the state of Mississippi. And yes, all my teeth and shoes. I can tell you this story because it's, well, one, I'm outside the lines of jurisdiction, so I don't have to worry about incarceration. And I'm sure the statute of limitations ended. See, back in the early 90s, I was, like most of us, a high school student needing money, and I worked at that wonderful restaurant called Dairy Queen. Being the enterprising young man I was a hard worker. I showed up on time. I didn't backtalk, so they made me a shift leader, which really meant they paid me like a dollar more an hour to be responsible. I got to take all the complaints, make the nightly deposits, and assign where people were working that day. Really didn't have that big of a draw until the local package store that happened to be across the street, I noticed that the gentleman that ran it each weekend night, named Byron, always came in for dinner. And because I was shift leader, my dinner was free. So I enticed him with the fact that I would be glad to make sure he had free dinner every night if he would afford me the opportunity to acquire alcohol at a deeply discounted rate while I was a minor. As you can tell, I'm one hell of a businessman. Lo and behold, at first I acquired liquor just simply to gain notoriety and improve my standing with the ladies. I was not quite as young, handsome, and debonair as I appear on this stage, I promise you. So lo and behold, after a couple of months of this, it was like, you know, this is fun and all, but I've got to find a way to really maximize this. And that's when I had this brilliant idea. And if we were in a movie, you would see a light bulb right here and you'd hear ding. I worked every weekend. I went to a high school of 2,500 kids that all wanted to drink and no one had access. So we had this wonderful drink called Mr. Misty. I don't know how many of you are familiar with slush puppies, but pretty much the same concept. You can get them in lime, raspberry, cherry. Well, our lowest seller was raspberry. So what I did is, using my network of influence, pushed out through the high school that anybody who wanted to come through on a Friday or a Saturday evening would come through the drive-thru and order a triple raspberry, and what they would get is a 16-ounce Mr. Misty with a jigger or 1.5 ounces of Bacardi rum. So for those of you that are a little bit slow with math, a typical fifth, you can get about 16 jiggers, so 16 sales out of that. At the time, a Mr. Misty 16-ounce was $1.18, and 7% sales tax, which was in Mississippi at the time, was $1.25. I would gladly take your five, pocket $3.75, and you would leave there with the rest. I'd put myself inside the drive-thru window, which was actually a little bit of a separate area from the rest of the store, and no one knew. 10/5 a weekend was my average. After covering my cost, I was averaging about $520 a weekend. It worked really well. My stature with the ladies went through the roof. All the cool kids loved me, but then I had a couple of hangers-on, people that were haters. So that's where my life of crime went from illegal underage alcohol distribution to extortion. I went to football players and used the threat of force, and then I went to slutty cheerleaders and used sexual means to put pressure on anybody that thought about whistleblowing my operation. Let's just say it was very effective. 3.5 years later, I partially paid for my college. I bought a car in cash, and I found out that I really needed to go in business. So that is my life of crime.
And that was Dan Williams, a Dairy Queen, pushing the envelope employee that he was.
You know, that probably is in the top five favorite stories of all time.
I knew you were going to say that. That seems like a very Bruce
spiking,
story.
Spiking the slushies, man. When I was in high school, I didn't work at Dairy Queen. I worked at McDonald's, but there was no way we could have like spiked the milkshakes or anything like that.
Oh, but you know what?
What a
Wendy's,
great idea.
You know, spiking those like milkshakes there. What are those called? Those Frosties?
Frosties,
oh,
yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I'm getting ideas.
Wish I would have thought of that when I was 16, but oh well.
Sure. All right, let's move it along. Our next story, work-related that is from Chad Johnson, who told the story at our Perfect Storm Story Slam back in 2016. Here is Chad Johnson.
So when you say the year 2008, many people either remember or repress it because of the Great Recession. Many people lost their homes, others involuntarily lost their jobs. And as for me, I voluntarily left my cushy career at Aurora Healthcare with two great options on the table. One, I had my potential third promotion waiting on me if I stayed with the company. Or two, I could take another job at another company that would have led to a six-figure salary within a few years. I'm 28 years old at the time. I'm responsible for 70% of household income. I have a wife and two children at home, and it's in the middle of a great recession, and I'm walking away from it all. Why in the world would I do that? Well, to give you a little backstory about me, I'm born and raised in Milwaukee, single parent mom, had four boys, went to Milwaukee Public Schools all the way from kindergarten to 12th grade, and got involved in Upward Bound in high school, so I said, hey, I'm going to college, right? Upward Bound, there you go. So I go to college, I graduate at 18, I go to UW-Whitewater, any Warhawks in the room? And I go to UW-Whitewater at 18, very next year at 19, I get an internship at Aurora Healthcare, so I'm on a good track. But that same year, at the age 19, I become a father. That's typically when the story goes downhill. But it didn't stop, because our parents said, you're finishing school. So I finished school, I graduated from college on time in 4 years, and at the age of 22, I got promoted to a full-time job at Aurora Healthcare. Very next year, I bought my first home at the age of 23, right down the way in Martin Drive neighborhood. And at the age of 23, I also bought a minivan. At the age of 24, I married the mother of my child, not my baby mama. And at that same time, at the age of 24, I also got my second promotion at Aurora Healthcare. At the age of 25, our second child was born, my son. So by this time, we've got a son, we've got a daughter, we're homeowners, we're married in Martin Drive, and we literally had a white picket fence, literally. 26, buy investment properties. 27, put money down on the lot to build a home. 28, buy more investment properties. So wait a minute, I'm a rarity. I'm a black male, city of Milwaukee, married, college educated, professional, and I'm walking away from it all. I had everything, but what was missing? Faith. I got to a point where I amassed a lot of possessions, I amassed a lot of prestige, but I indirectly took the credit for it. So in 2008, it was more of a spiritual conviction year for me. So I walked away from it all where God had to get my attention. So ultimately what happened is, after I left my career, here are the things we went through. One of the first things we had to do was we couldn't afford DirecTV anymore. Now, when I left my job, my wife was very supportive. If God says it, I'll support you. But when I said we got to turn in the DirecTV box, honey, she needed a moment. Really? Additionally, I went the first 2 years without a salary. We were down to one vehicle for 4 years because the engine went out on the second car. My wife's salary was frozen for 3 years during that time. We unfortunately lost our home to foreclosure. And during one season, my daughter's Christmas list was on necessities versus amenities. She said, I just want a comforter. I wanted some deodorant that I liked and some snow boots. I went from amassing many possessions to necessities on Christmas. Well, all wasn't bad. We got more involved in ministry and serving the community. Because we didn't have TV and internet for nearly 4 years, we got closer as a family. We did more things like talk and eat together as a family. Additionally, riding together in the same car for 4 years together forced my wife and I to talk more. And it forced us on those days where we didn't necessarily like each other, we had to acknowledge one another and not let things fester. It actually grew us closer together. Additionally, our finances were restored after some time of going through a major desert, where I started my training consulting company in 2013. And in my second year of business, I was able to invoice over six figures worth of business as a training consultant. Additionally, we became homeowners again. We purchased on the historic Grant Boulevard in Sherman Park back a couple years ago. And additionally, as I look at it, just like gold has to go through fire to remove impurities, just like plants have to be pruned to get rid of dead leaves so that they can grow more and produce more fruit, I too realized I had to go through that storm to remove some impurities, to remove some of those dead leaves that weren't really adding much value, not only to me, but to others, because I realized it wasn't about me. So at the end of the day, I realized God perfected me in the storm. Thank you.
And that was Chad Johnson's story, work-related, from our Perfect Storm Story Slam.
Yeah, this is a guy who, speaking of risking it, gave it all up for a complete change of life. And that's, you know, you got to applaud someone who does that. That takes guts to risk it like that.
Yeah, it really does. So, hats off.
You like my tie in there to risking it?
Holy cats, yes. You got them all down. Good segues. So let's just do a little recap. First of all, I want to thank everybody for listening today to our little radio show. And if you want to hear more stories, we have buckets of story slams and story-related activities coming up. The most notable ones I wanted to talk about are November 9th Story Slam at 3041 North, where we're going to have a work themed story slam. So please, Milwaukee, bring your work stories. And then on the 14th, Equal Access Story Circle, November 17th, a curated Risking It Story Slam in partnership with the South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center. Volunteer orientation. Ugh, it just doesn't stop with us, you know? It just doesn't stop.
It is a busy, busy XFAB November, that's for sure.
Pwiswinton.
I'm looking forward to the work stories because the businesses that I worked in, the media, you encounter a lot of people that supply you with a lot of stories. Some you can tell, some you can't, but I'm looking forward to other people's work stories.
Oh, yeah. I wish I could grab the mic. I have like a patchwork quilt of like my employee background, my resume and such, and in a good way.
In a good way. Absolutely. Well, if you want to hear today's stories again or share them, they are at WUWM.com. And as Leah said, more information about all these XFabula November events are at
XFabula.org.
You got it. And we'll be back next week with more. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
XFabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and every Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned for Weekend All Things Considered. It's coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.